Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Ashley Beadle, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast, and I'm glad to be here.
House Culture.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode in season 2 of the House Culture Podcast. I'm your host and the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. Feels great to be talking to you live and direct, and with lockdown measures starting to ease, I'm hoping this taste of clubland can get you excited for the feast that awaits us all. We've had tons of fantastic feedback for this second season, so I want to say thank you to everyone who has got in touch and wished us well. So many of you have already listened to our chats with the legendary Norman Cook, Ibiza icon Dawn Hindle, DJ and Colossus Tall Paul, purveyor of the happiest sounds in house music Sophie Lloyd, Melon Bomber Scott Gray, DJ Magazine's only ever number one female DJ Smoking Joe, Grammy-nominated producer The Scumfrog, and Pike's resident DJ Paul Linney. Phew, that's a list I'm pretty proud of, to be honest, but believe me, there is plenty more to come. And if you haven't done already, don't be afraid to get yourself some dusty digital fingers by digging through our equally impressive back catalogue from Season 1. And there you'll find conversations with scenesters such as Brandon Block, Greg Wilson, Sally Rogers, Terry Farley, Fat Phil Cooper, and many more. Also, if you've only just discovered this podcast and are wondering what House Culture is all about, our credo is that we are a collective of house music fans who have come together through our mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. We're on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, so come join us on that virtual dance floor. We can come together to revel in all things related to this beautiful scene. Let's get moving with this episode, shall we? In this, we chat to artist, remixer, producer, and one third of dance music supergroup Express 2. It's Ashley Beadle. In this chat, you can hear Ashley's take on how new musical movements are born.
Let's be honest now, right? For any scene to work, it needs two things to happen. Musical advancement and drugs. If you've got ecstasy combined with acid house, Jesus Christ, something's got to happen, right?
How some new friends helped him expand his already huge passion for music.
That's where I met Terry Farley and Andrew Weatherall. And it was extraordinary times, you know, because all of a sudden, coming from black sound system culture, if you like, to these guys that are introducing me to, hold on, I don't know anything about these records. What are these records?
What it was like being part of that dance music supergroup.
Express 2 was a juggernaut. To this day, I can't get my head around it sometimes, you know. It was like, what?
And you'll have to listen to the whole thing if you want to know which one of his productions he was talking about here.
When you make a record like that, and that's where it ends up, in a film that Spike Lee's directed, you can go to fucking heaven happy.
This chat was recorded in one of Ashley's local pubs, remember those? So there's quite a bit of atmosphere going on that, if you haven't been lucky enough to get yourself out to one recently, will hopefully transport you to your favourite drinking den. So pull up a chair, grab a drink, get ready to listen. This is Ashley Beadle.
House Culture.
Hi, Ashley. Thank you so much for inviting us down to your manor.
Thank you, Matt. I mean, no, thank you. And sorry about all the noise, everybody.
That's all right.
We'll get round it.
We're in a lovely pub down here in Ramsgate. It's got a real atmosphere. And yeah, it's a pleasure to make your acquaintance.
Yes.
You're obviously a famous DJ, producer, remixer, a member of dance music outfits such as Express 2. But we always like to kind of rewind and start at the beginning on the podcast and ask you, how did you first discover a love of music growing up?
I've actually mentioned this many times before. A love of music, I think for me growing up, came through my parents. My dad was an avid record collector. My mum loved music purely from, I think, having a good time and dancing. But she had particular people she loved, which was a lot of gospel, the original kind of Blue Beat ska records, Rocksteady. Reggae. My dad loved all that music as well, but then obviously he upped his game and he was going into like rock records, soul records, you know, classical records, mad things. Yeah. And there was stuff that my dad would play, and I would like, I would ask him, you know, who's that? And my dad would go, oh, come over here, and we'd sit down, and then he'd go over the sleeve, and you know, oh, it's produced by such and such. That person played guitar. That person played drums. And from that, I learnt probably the idea of how production worked by looking at these people on these records. Yeah. And it was in my later years, I suppose, when I hit about probably about 12, 13, 14, and my dad got me a stereo for my bedroom. And I think Capital Radio had just come along, and there was some quite interesting DJs on Capital Radio at the time, one of them being Nicky Horn. Now he used to come on at 9 o'clock at night, so you can imagine I'd come home from school, have me bath, do me homework, lie in bed and wait for Nicky Horn to come on. And extraordinary radio shows, if you like, where, you know, Nicky Horn would be like, hi everybody, I'm flying in a helicopter over the Colorado and I'm going to go and see Bruce Springsteen. Actually, Nicky Horn didn't have an American accent. That's just me. But, you know, he'd be like, yeah, we're going to go and see Bruce Springsteen live and da-da-da. You know, this is the future of rock and roll. And, you know, you'd be there lying under your bed covers thinking, oh, my God, you know what I mean? What's going on here? And I had moments, you know, like hearing Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run for the first time, running into my dad's bedroom, who happens to be stark naked at the time, with my mother, and saying, come with me, Dad, and listen to this, you know. We both stood there, like, in awe of, my God, you know what I mean, what is going on? And, you know, and my dad went with the flow. He was a big punk fan. He was into glam. Yeah. You know, it's fantastic growing up. Yeah. It was really beautiful. And also my mum and dad's friends of that era, of that age, you know, were incredible as well. So I was open to so much music. And then, you know, like a lot of us, we rebelled at a very young age, you know, and 14, 15, all of a sudden I became into my reggae, you know, and then decided, oh, I like a bit of reggae, but I'm going to be a soul boy as well. you know, so I had...
So where was this?
This
when you
was
were
in Harrow.
Up?
So, and Harrow at the time, you know, in the '70s, was an amazing place. Mm. Okay, everyone talks about Harrow. They always think about the public school on top of the hill. But in its what were laid around it was all these amazing little nightclubs, where you'd have very famous DJs at the time, like Greg Edwards and Robbie Vincent, Chris Hill. Yep. They'd all come to Harrow.
Yeah,
you know, and you had the Harrow Leisure Centre, where there was skating discos. So, you know, it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. You didn't have to go to London.
Yeah.
But then I had my last year at school, I used to go to a place called Mount View High School. And my last year at school, I had a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, who, funny enough, I've just got in touch with many, after not seeing him for many years, a guy called Terry Johns. And he took me to Crackers on a Friday lunchtime. That changed my life.
Yeah.
And That's where Farley, Terry Farley and all that used to go as well. Yeah. Paul Anderson, who's sadly passed away. But I met so many people there for the first time at Crackers.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where I first acknowledged, you know, the true ethic of what being a soul boy was, and watching the dancing and, you know, walking away and going home and standing in front of the mirror and going, right, I can do that, I can do that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because I suppose at that time, that whole community, it wasn't really represented, like, visually in a way. Like, you'd hear the music on the radio, for instance, but actually, I suppose, going in there and witnessing the whole package, the dancing, the fashion, the music all brought together, I suppose that's a real kind of moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was so much going on. You know, there was things like the Case to Soul weekends, which came a little bit later. Yeah. There was all dayers that we went to. It was incredible, absolutely incredible. You know, I mean, there's so many tales. I remember going to a particular club in, I think it was Oxford, Didcot, and the resident band in the club happened to be Haircut 100, and they were soul boys.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there they were, and we were quite friendly with them. And then one day I remember switching on Top of the Pops, and there they were, Haircut 100. Like, how did you go from, you know, Didcot to Top of the Pops, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's just amazing times like that. People like Spandau Ballet, you know, watching them in the early days, you know, and then them becoming massive. And people like Freeze, the band Freeze.
Yep.
And I remember walking once in Chapel Market very drunk and a little bit off my head because I'd heard that Ingrid, the lead singer, lived there. And I lived in City Road at the time in near Old Street. And I remember walking up Chapel Market going, Ingrid! About 5 o'clock in the morning. And luckily not getting arrested. So, yeah.
I mean, being exposed to all of that and having that musical education, like the sleeve notes and the understanding of the production, and was there a will to get involved and pick up an instrument?
It's really funny, actually, because when I look back, my dad's side of the family were extremely musical. Mm. They had a band called Reflections, which did a lot of the kind of working men's clubs around Hertfordshire, etc., etc. And they managed to get onto, at the time, a TV programme called Opportunity Knocks with Huey Green. They didn't win, but it did open my eyes to the fact that, you know, yeah, my family's all right here. But I did get some drums from my mum because I was very percussive.
Okay.
But what happened was my mum said, you know, you'll have to go downstairs and practice in the kind of community hall because I don't want you making noise in the flat. It's fine. And I went down there, took the drums down there, put them in the cupboard and never touched them again because all of a sudden I found online the Mattel electronic drum kit. So that took over. I bought that instead.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it was like, okay. And that kind of coincided with the way music was changing from live bands to the electronic disco sound, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, okay, this is how it works.
Yeah.
So I kind of started following that route rather than, you know, even though I still love bands, don't get me wrong, the idea of going into the studio and, you know, fiddling with boxes and making lots of noises, to me, appealed more.
More control over
more
that
control,
as well.
Yeah.
I mean, so you were kind of in that soul boy scene, and there are so many stories around, like we spoke to Terry Farley, and like you hear like Pete Tong talk about it as well, in terms of that seems to be kind of the natural progression into when house music exploded.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think the soul boy scene and that community was the right place at the right time to take on the mantle of house music and push that forward when that exploded?
Yeah, well, I think, let's be honest now, right? For any scene to work, it needs two things to happen. Musical advancement and drugs. Now, my lovely wife, Jo, we've had many conversations about this. And I'm talking about Jo Wallace, by the way. She said to me, like, you know, when you went, because she's an original mod, you know, and she also went to the Northern, you know, 76, she was going to Wigan's Casino.
Yeah.
And she said to me, you know, she could be there with the most amazing, if she doesn't mind me saying so, you know, the latest Black and Blues or whatever the hell they were called, you know, and just departing her body to these incredible records that Richard Serling would be playing, you know. And she was telling me about that, and I've always bugged her about, wow, you know, and she'd go onto YouTube and play me those particular records, and you can hear it there, why people needed to neck the latest high-grade speed and get on the floor to that, while we decided to go first speed, not very good speed down this end of the world, but then, you know, Ecstasy came along. My God, you know, if you got Ecstasy combined with Acid House, Jesus Christ. Something's got to happen, right?
The heavens opened.
Yeah, it absolutely did. You know, and I was absorbed, like a lot of us were, into a world that was just incredible. You know, I was in the Shock sound system at the time. So I got to give big respects to Stanley, Dean, Cecil, Paul, Ricky, all the crew, Emix, Dirty Harry, all that lot. But, you know, Shock sound system, we started out doing rare groove hip hop, etc., like most of the sounds, and we discovered house. And we were lucky enough to do one of the rooms at the infamous Clink Street. Now, Clink Street was running exactly the same time as Shum. What would happen was Shum would close at 2, bang. All the Shummers literally walk over the road into Clink Street, and we'd see people like Boy George and Mark Moore. But the house was different. The house music was different. So in Clink Street, the house music was blacker. It was more Chicago. It was more people like Kid Bachelor, Eddie Richards, Mr. C, Shock Sound System were playing that, you know? And then these guys would come over from Shum, which was obviously more happy, happy, Balearic, Balearic. Brilliant music, but it was just weird how these two musics would exist, you know? And a lot of those guys that came over from Shum, I became very friendly with. And due to certain circumstances that we'll talk about later, you know, eventually I became onto that scene.
I mean, it's interesting you make that distinction between kind of Shum and Clink Street. Like, kind of looking back, everyone kind of says, oh, it's house music and it all came over and it was like a merging of Chicago sound and the Balearic sound. And really, they were two distinct sounds at that stage. They weren't necessarily all encompassed under house music.
No, they were definitely, I would say, two distinct sounds. Definitely, you know, I remember bumping in the very early years to people like Nancy Noyes and that, and we'd be playing somewhere in Green Lanes at the arena, you know, we'll come on with house, and Nancy was playing, who's the Australian group? Michael.
Oh, INXS.
INXS. Need You Tonight.
Yeah.
And she was playing like the 12-inch mix of that, and Sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Peter Gabriel, and we were just standing there on the floor looking at her, doing. Not knowing that she was doing that, she was playing those records at Future.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's only till later on we were beginning to understand. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's more about the context with those types of types of records.
This is what they were bringing back from Ibiza. What Alfredo was doing
specifically house music. What your first exposure to house music? What are your indelible memories of that? Was it a club experience, or you heard it on the radio? Or
I can honestly say I was introduced to house music by Shock Sound System.
Yeah,
that Stanley and Dean, I think, were very early. They caught onto it very early.
Yeah.
And they were going up north to, I think it might have been Leicester, to play against another sound system called Formation 5.
Okay, yeah.
I hope I got that right. And then we used to go up there and play against them. And I used to go up really as a box boy, you know, helping carrying the speakers and that. And I remember hearing things like, you know, Adonis, No Way Back, for the first time. In my stupid head, I'm thinking, God, this is reggae, but really fast. I thought it was dancehall or something. I was like, what's this? You know, I think, I don't understand it. Yeah. And then, you know, Stanley and Dean Zephyrin from Shock were like, Ash, you know, this is house music, mate. Okay. Yeah. And then we used to go to Jazzy M shop in Croydon.
Yeah.
And we'd go down there and he had, you know, Jazzy M and Jasper the Vinyl Junkie working there. And basically, that's when I started buying physical records, you know.
So those records you were buying, the first records you were buying were house music records?
No, before that, obviously, I was buying reggae and soul.
Yeah, yeah.
And rare groove.
Yeah.
You know, because I was lucky enough to be taught about those sort of styles by Roy de Roach.
Yeah.
Because I had a Saturday job at Quaff in Finsbury Park before the whole house music thing, you know. Yeah. But... you know, once the house music hit, that was it.
Yeah. For me, you know, Frankie Knuckles described house music as disco's revenge. And for me, it made that was for me, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense to me now.
Yeah, you know? I mean, in that era as well, disco in some circles was almost like a dirty word. It was like dead as disco, you know. It was this thing that had been done.
Yeah.
But really, when you do look back on that through line of history, especially from America, where that house music sound came from, it's all grown and nurtured from disco. And disco has had this massive kind of resurgence, and people are paying homage to that, rightly so now, I think.
Yes, absolutely. It's never gone away.
No.
It's never gone away, and it never will. As long as there's the people that are trusted and willing to carry that vibe through, it'd be fantastic,
So you've been buying records for Jazzy M, getting into that house music sound. Was this in a way of just collecting them as a collector, or were you?
I was physically buying them to DJ. Yeah. You know, because Dean and Stan were teaching me the art of DJing, you know, which was good as well, you know, how to cue a record, how to beat mix a record, you know what I mean? You know, so that was fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And how kind of quickly did you get the hang of it? And, you know, was it, I need to get this down, I'm going to start DJing in clubs and get some gigs, or was it a
long slog? I was happy being with the sound system. I was very much a born natural, really, do you know what I mean? I love being on the mic, which was a hangover from the sound system as well. But unfortunately, with Shock Sound System, I had a little stay with Her Majesty's Pleasure. So when I came out, part of my part of my bell conditions, if you like, was to have a job. Now, I got offered a job at Black Market by Rennie Gelston, who was the owner at the time. And he said, but it's going to take a couple of weeks. We're going to have to try and get you a job in between the period before you start at Black Market. I ended up at Pop Promotions, Boys Own, in the Boys Own offices, which is in Labour Grove. And it was myself, Darren Price, who I think might have had a little bit of time as well with Her Majesty. But anyway, we were there. And we were sticking records into mailers and posting them out, you know. And that's where I met Terry Farley and Andrew Weatherall. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was extraordinary times, you know, because all of a sudden, coming from black sound system culture, if you like, to these guys that are introducing me to, hold on, I don't know anything about these records.
Yeah.
What are these records? And all of a sudden, I started to go out to places like Phil Perry's Queens, which is on Windsor Reservoir. And I went out there with Wayne Shires, an old girlfriend of mine at the time. Susie Jones introduced me to a lot of people. And it was quite extraordinary. You know, you'd be out afternoon in this kind of big dance hall on a reservoir, watching people off their heads going mad to, like, the most strangest records I think I've ever heard. Do you know what I mean? And just, I spent most of my time with a pen and a bit of paper, going up to the decks, i.e. if Andrew Weatherall was playing, and saying, what's that, mate? And being really annoying.
I think it's certainly had that taste, selector style from very, very early.
Very early, and they were playing, and it really appealed to me, because I was constantly, I think, even when I was a soul boy, going back to that whole thing, I got bored so quickly, because it became a bit regimented.
Yep.
And all of a sudden I found Orange Juice. Their first ever single to this day sends me into states of ecstasy, you know. Brilliant record.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, Simply Thrilled Honey, it's called. And, you know, for bands like A Certain Ratio and that. And, you know, in a lot of kind of what I would classify now probably as indie funk, you know.
Yeah.
It made more sense to me. And so you could still dance to it, but it was a bit more edgy, a bit more mental, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that was kind of creeping in. So when I was going to see people like Weatherall and Farley, Phil Perry, do you know what I mean? And all these other DJs who were playing this stuff, it started to make sense, because all of a sudden I'm thinking, oh, right, okay, I can connect with that record now.
Yeah.
why they're playing that record, because they were looking for something a little bit different as well.
Yeah, I know. Obviously, we spoke to Terry on the podcast as well, and he talks about how they're almost always 2 years ahead of the curve in terms of that Boyzone sound, and totally can see that looking back. Things like Boca Juniors and things now, they sound like absolute dance floor monsters, but back then no one wanted that kind of sound at that time.
Well, I mean, you know, they were hilarious, that lot. How they did things, I don't know, because they're all over the bloody shop. And I remember when Boca Juniors came into the office, you know, and listening to it, and we're going, blimey, you know, what'd you do with that, you know? But then the incredible thing was when I got eventually to work at Black Market Records, which was for about, might have been a couple of years, that's where I really grounded myself in how dance music production worked, but just by listening to the records. So, you know, I give special thanks to Rene Gelston and Dave Piccioni, you know, because Dave took it over after Rene, the shop. And he was, even Dave was allowing me to kind of find acts for him to put out on his Azuli label, and getting records coming in from America and listening to these records. And this was at the time, I think, when the whole US garage sound was coming into play. Tony Humphries, you know, all that kind of stuff was becoming very predominant in the clubs. I love that shit. Trust me. That was, you know, and that's where I started meeting people like Phil Asher and that crowd, and realising, oh, this is the New Jersey sound.
You know,
I love this shit. That was kind of really beginning to impact on me and how I wanted to make a record. Then one day, to cut a long story short, I got sacked from Black Market for being involved in a very dodgy bootleg. But that's another story. But rightfully sacked, I must say. I'll put my hands up. And thank you for Dave Piccioni for sacking me.
What was the bootleg, can I ask?
Mass Order. Lift Every Voice. Yeah. Which was Billy and Chips, who were Boyzone associates, shall we say, were involved, and I was involved in the distribution aspect of it. And anyway, but cut a long story short, I was sitting at home and I was really kind of a bit upset because obviously my job wasn't there with the record shop. And then one day I was down Cheapo Cheapo's, which is at the bottom of Brewer Street. And anyway, so I was in Cheapo Cheapo's, and Norman Jay's in there. And I kind of knew Norman from the sound system scene, you know. And he was up on the racks, on a ladder, pulling stuff up. And Norman turned around to me and said, look, you need this, Ashley. You really need this tune. If you like your disco, you need this. And it was the Tramps album, Tramps 3.
Yeah.
And it had Where Were You When the Lights Went Out in New York City, you know. I was like, oh, okay. So I got home and I put it on the decks, listened to the whole album. Then it got to Where Were You When the Lights Went Out. And I heard this section. I went, oh, my God. Right, okay. How am I going to do this? And I'd already that time made a very small production with a guy called Eddie Jones and another guy called Simon, whose name I can't, surname I can't remember. But Eddie Jones was the brother of my girlfriend at the time.
Yeah.
And he had, I think we were called the Psychic Vitamins. And it was a real, it was a breakbeat record with a Hendrix sample. Okay. Yeah. And so that was really my first ever release, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was listening to this tune and then I thought, right, so the guy whose studio I think we used for Psychic Vitamins, I rang him up and it was a guy called Danny Arno. Brilliant producer and friend. He said, look, come over. So I then rang up Rob Mello, who was working at Zoom Records then in Camden, which was where the old Soul to Soul shop used to be.
Yeah.
And I said, Rob, man, should we go in the studio? And he's like, all right, what are we going to do? And I told him, we went in. And how he did it, I don't know. And I think Rob played the bass line, and that became Black Science Orchestra, Where Were You?
Yeah.
And didn't think nothing of it. And because I knew Terry and Andrew and everyone at Boyzone, I said, look, I've got this DAT. Can you have a listen to it? Yeah, bring it over. So I went up to the office, put it on, and they went, yeah, we'll have it. Really? Yeah, we'll have it. Okay. So eventually that came out as where were you? Black Science Orchestra, four tracks on a 12, mm-hmm. you know. And I was really proud. I was like, wow, you know. And it was me, Rob, and another guy, John, that was involved, who was my flatmate. And basically, didn't you know, it didn't really do a lot. Then, it, for some reason, in America, or in New York, I should say, Frankie Knuckles discovered it. And I'd gone over to the States, I think, to do... I started to get DJing work and stuff, you know. But I'd gone over to the States, and I was in this club, and it was called Cheetah. And it was run by... oh, God, I always get this wrong. Barbara, she'd done Beautiful People. She was affiliated. She had her own club at Cheetah, and it was Barbara... can't remember now. And anyway, so... I was in the club, and then there was Benji Candelario, mm-hmm. big New York DJ, you know. And we were chatting, and he said, man, he goes, you know, your record, man, it's just like blowing up, man. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, your record's blowing up. You don't, you know? I was like, I'm not, what are you talking about? I ain't got a clue. I mean, Frankie's broken your record, man. And I was like, really? And Frankie was in the club that night. It was a Thursday night or something. And he put it on. And David Cole from Clivillers and Cole was kind of like the in-house keyboard player. So he used to play over the tracks as they were playing on record. And so he was doing it. And I'm like, wow, what's going on here, you know? And Frankie came off to let someone else DJ for a little bit. And he was standing by the bar. And Benji said to me, look, do you want to go and meet Frankie? And I went, Frankie Knuckles, you know. So off we went over. He introduced me to Frankie, and Frankie looked at me and he said, you the man that made that record, the Black Science Orchestra, where were you? And I thought, yeah. And he went, no. I turned around to Frankie. I went, well, listen, Frankie, thank you for playing. He went, no, Ashley, thank you for making it. And that's true. And we became very good friends after that.
Oh, it's, yeah, such an incredible man. I mean, that record and just that whole Black Science Orchestra sound in general, it had that soulful American sound. Was there any surprise on that side of the Atlantic that some Brits had made this record?
Yes, there was this huge kind of like, who is this guy? Why is he making records like this?
Really?
You know, because there was only a couple of us really. Phil Asher, I would count in there, you know, and Rob Mello as well, who were really kind of making those homages, if you like, to the American sound. You know, when they were looking at us and seeing who we were, they were like, what? You know, and then eventually when we got onto the next release, which is New Jersey Deep,
yeah,
that EP, that, and then Frankie Knuckles, not Frankie Knuckles, Masters at Work, you know, Kenny and Louie broke it. They broke that tune. And eventually, I think from that, No Ego Intended, you know, that's when they realised, okay, the gauntlet's been thrown down here. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because I think what we were doing, and I'm not talking about just me, I'm talking about all the British producers, you know, what we were actually doing, we were putting a very, very UK slant because of the other stuff we were listening to,
yeah,
against these American records. Yeah. You know, because we were being immersed in African music, and so were they, but I think we took it on. But then we were going into things like Kraftwerk and a lot of European stuff, which they weren't.
Yeah.
But we were, you know, listening to Kosmische, or Krautrock is what people call it.
Yeah.
But we were listening to a lot of that as well. So that was kind of becoming evident in our productions, you know. Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned New Jersey Deep. I mean, that track to me is almost timeless in its composition, its instrumentation. It's really lush. It's got a breakbeat on it. You know, it still gets a reaction now. Was the feeling when you made that, obviously the first four track EP, Black Science Orchestra, you were kind of happy to get that out there, and then Frankie Knuckles takes it on, it's amazing, and then the next one, was there the pressure on yourself to deliver a New Jersey Deep, something that good, or
no,
was it just
not at all the
ignorance of youth and just
it was ignorance totally, you know. And I found the sample, Wood, Brass and Steel, mm-hmm. Which is cleared now, but I found a sample, and I'm not joking. We, you know, myself, Mark Wolford, Ushi Clarkson was in the studio, and we hooked that groove up in 3 hours. Trust me, 3 hours.
Wow!
And it took about an hour to mix. You know, we were so on fire.
Yeah.
You know, what we were doing. Yeah, so on fire. I think the whole EP was, we did it in 2 days. Walked out the studio, you know, and just said, that's a killer.
Yeah.
That's the speed we were working at then. When I look back, I don't regret anything regarding production.
Mm.
That's what they sounded like. They sounded like dub plates, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Once New Jersey Deep had finished, I think that's when kind of we did Strong, which I did with Phil Asher and Lindsay Edwards, who was a guy I was working with at the time. We did Strong. That didn't sell as much, but now people are now looking at that as that was a very interesting record. And I think I was trying to get a bit more esoteric. And then Steve Hall at Boyzone, who was kind of A&R heading it over there, he said, can you do an album? I was like, what's that? So, you know, off we went, did the album as well, which ridiculously consisted of samples. And then he sent me back in the studio. He said, look, we can't clear these.
Oh,
can you copy them? Can you do interpolations? And I went, yeah, okay, we can. So we did, and then came out with the, you know, Walter's Room album.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, well, as you know, and probably lots of other people know, you know, this is all going on. And at the same time, Express 2 was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Ballistic Brothers was happening. Mm-hmm. You know, Express 2 was a juggernaut.
Yeah.
How, to this day, I can't get my head around it sometimes. You know, it was like, what?
I just want to talk about that specifically. Obviously, you're one of the founding members with Rocky and Diesel. How did you first meet those guys? Was it just in and amongst the
Rocky
boys?
Rocky and Diesel I met at the Windsor Club, Queens.
Mm.
because they were in a fanzine. I think the fanzine was called Fresh Air. I think it was called that. I mean, Rocky and Diesel could correct me. And I remember seeing them in the fanzine first because they were a duo. And I thought, oh, they sound interesting. And I think it was a track listing of the tracks they were playing at the time.
Yeah.
And they happened to be in Queens, and I introduced myself, you know. Anyway, cut a long story short, once again, Terry, once I'd done Black Science Orchestra, the first EP, Terry said, oh, Rocky and Diesel want to go in the studio. You're a producer. Can you go and help them? No. And I was laughing my head off because I thought, well, I'm not really a producer. What do I do here? So it was literally in those days. I remember turning up to the studio with a bag of records, Rocky and Diesel as well, you know, and just sampling the shit out of records and getting ideas. And when we did Music Express, I remember got totally freaked out, flipped, and left Rocky and Diesel in the studio and went home and left them there, you know.
What, before you created that? Yeah.
And I left them there. And the next day, we all went back into the studio. I think I'm telling it correctly. And Rocky said, oh, I think we've got something here. And I listened to it. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. And then, you know, pretending to be a producer. And the next thing, they said, well, look, why don't we give it to Fabi Paras, who was a big DJ at the time. So they got an acetate cut, gave it to Fabi, and Terry Farley and Fabi went off to do a gig up north somewhere, I think.
Mm.
Next day, we get this phone call from Fabi. Bloody hell! It's mental! What's mental? The tune!
Yeah.
This bloody Express 2 record. So, oh, it was hilarious. So Terry had already kind of decided that he would, because it was Rocky and Diesel, he was really into the name S Express,
yeah.
Mark Moore's group. So he said, oh, we're going to call you Express 2, Rocky and Diesel. And you, Ash, can be the silent partner. I went, all right then, because you know, you're Black Science Orchestra, you can't really be, you know. I was like, fair enough, you know. But then eventually, you know, everyone said, oh, look, you might as well be Express 2, but there's three of you. That'll confuse people, you know what I mean? And then, you know, so, yeah, Music Express, London Express, which is a bonkers record.
Yeah.
Say What, which was Terry Farley's idea of marrying Go-Go and House. And that went to number 30 in the national chart. Yeah. And then, obviously, we had a few more singles which didn't do as brilliant, but... And then obviously we got to the point of creating Lazy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, I mean, Musicism, that album during that period as well, that kind of like late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
And I'm really jumping ahead here, but we'll continue the Express 2 bit. That album contains Lazy, it's got Smoke Machine on it, it's got AC/DC on it, Musicism, yeah. The two mixes of that that came out yeah. are awesome. You know, it's absolutely stacked up. You know, was it just, again, just going in the studio for a few hours and whacking them together, or was there foresight in terms of wanting to create a dance music album?
I think there was a real foresight into wanting to create. I think there was a lot of at the time there was the Miami Music Conference was seeping into everyone then.
Yeah.
And Rocky definitely was a big fan of I don't think I went to the Groove Jet parties. Danny Tenaglia.
Yeah.
And Rocky was a big fan, and Diesel was as well. So they were bringing that to the table, you know, and I would, and because of my at the time I was really getting into the whole production outside of Express 2, yeah. So I was bringing that to the table as well, you know. So and we were recording in a studio that I owned at the time,
yeah.
So all my records were in there, so it was brilliant. We could go, all right, we'll have a listen to that, you know. Yeah. And Rocky and Diesel equally would have brilliant ideas. Yeah. To bring to the tracks, you know, and we were anarchic. We just didn't care, you know. And I mean, Lazy, for instance, started off as a little mad tune.
Yeah.
And it was myself and Rocky over a Prince-type beat going, I can actually remember it, goes, I got your number, I got your number, baby. I got your number, you know you drive me crazy. And that was it. And James Brown, who was our engineer, this guy, he turned around, lovely guy, by the way, engineer, Australian engineer, he was fantastic, very funny, and he turned around and he went, that sounds a bit like Talking Heads, and I went, does it? And he was like, yeah, and Rocky went, does it? And the funny thing was, David Byrne had already contacted the Ballistic Brothers a while back.
No way.
Because he wanted to work with us as a live band, and we had to explain to him that we didn't exist. It was a total studio project.
Yeah.
And he totally understood. And he said, oh, well, maybe one day we'll work together, you know. But I still had his details. So I contacted him. And he said, look, send the track over. A couple of weeks, this thing came back. And it was Lazy. And we were like, he's made a dance record about being bloody lazy. How'd you do that? And it took us a few months to construct the piano with a guy called Pete Zedd,
yeah,
to construct the piano and get the whole structure of the sound right.
Yeah.
But you know, Rocky turned round to me. I distinctly remember this, and he said to me, "It's going to be a big club hit." I went, "No, it's not. That's going to be big.
Yeah,
that's big, mate.
Yeah,
you know."
And it's got to number one as well.
Number
it?
Two.
Was it number two?
Yes, we were kept off the top by Gareth Gates doing "Spirit in the Sky," but we sold more than him. There you go.
Well, yeah. You're the ultimate winners in the battle with Gareth.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's incredible. Yeah, it's still such, I mean, obviously you've chosen your five tracks for us, which we'll talk about soon.
Yeah.
And I listened to them all on the way down. And like just hearing again that track, Lazy, just in headphones and just the depth of it is, yeah, it's still got so much going on in it that
yeah.
I hadn't heard it in that in my headphones for so long.
Mm.
Yeah, it's still great. But yeah, I mean, I remember back in those years, there was a group of us who used to put on kind of small scale DJ events in London, and a friend of mine who was well known for always wanting to play last and play the bangers, he ended up playing like the warm up one time, and he was like, okay, I'm going to play a warm up set. And we're like, right, okay, you play your warm up set then. And the first track he put on was Express 2 AC/DC.
That's not a warm up.
We're like, is this your warm up track?
Yeah, oh my god.
Like, oh my god.
This is my yeah. ballad.
Amazing. I mean, and as an entity as well, Express 2, when you played live, and I had seen you live a few times over those years, you know, there were all of you behind the decks, like four, five, six decks on the go all at once. It was a real performance.
Mm.
Like, how did you kind of like navigate that when you're all together up there?
Well, you had to have a friendly demo, a friendly dictator,
yeah.
which was Rocky.
Yeah.
So Rocky was in the centre. I was to the... So if I'm facing you, I was to the right, and then Diesel was to the left of Rocky.
Yeah.
So Rocky would start it, then it would go over to me, and then I would signal, and we'd have our little secret signals, then over to Diesel. And then that's how it worked.
Oh, no way.
You know?
Yeah.
And then would be like, Rocky would say, look, I'm going to play maybe an extra record.
Yeah. Was it democratic in terms of track choices? Were there surprises, or were you all kind of semi-agreed?
Semi-agreed, I think. Yeah. There were moments when Rocky was the one that would pull something out, I think, and you go, how did you do that? You know, it'd be something like a cut-up of Mark Bolan, Get It On, and he would do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And you'll go, wow.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Where did that appear from? He goes, oh, yeah, a mate of mine put this together the other day, you know. It'd be something like that.
Yeah.
You know, or we'd hear something like a good friend of ours at the time, Matt... I can't remember his recording name now, but he did that Get What You Give, that, you know, the big You Better Get What You
oh,
Give.
Oh yeah, Dun. Yeah.
He
yeah,
did a cut up of
New
that.
Radicals, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, New Radicals.
Mm.
And we had that for ages on dub plate.
Yeah.
Killed him.
Yeah.
You know, when we had our residency at Fabric.
Yeah.
We were killing it in there.
You mentioned Fabric, and obviously when that, they had some issues where the place got shut for a bit, and there was a whole outpouring of emotion around the club community that kind of rallied around and did rescue the club. Obviously, having been a part of that, the fabric, what were your feelings on that when that happened?
I thought it was really wrong. I thought, to be honest with you, I thought it was just government persecution, basically. There was a lot of behind the scenes activity. There was a lot of new places, shall we say, being built, and property developers were with money, were going to the local council, to the government, and I think words were said. I personally think that.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that someone had passed away outside the club, shall we say, because of drug use or whatever, was used as the scapegoat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Could have happened anywhere.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about your production and your remix work and everything. I mean, you're really well known as someone who can deliver an amazing remix or sometimes re-edit as well. You work with some greats. I'm thinking like Elton John, the Bob Marley family.
Yeah.
A particular favourite of mine, of yours, is your astonishing remix of Always by Bent.
Yeah, that's the happy
one?
Albatross round my neck. Shall we?
Sorry to bring it up.
Yeah, no, it's you know, I've lived with it now, and I've fallen in love with this again. You know, that one and the mix I did for The Streets.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're records where, you know, I'm one of those people. I'm a great believer in spirit. I'm a great believer in stuff falling out of the sky on a particular day, and when I did those mixes, that's what happened.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You just had, everything just seemed to mathematically be right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like boom, there you go.
And when you approach just a remix, I suppose in general, is it just a blank sheet of paper each time, or are you like, okay, I'm Like, what's your kind of workflow in?
I always believe in the structure of the original track having to be there. Mm-hmm. Whether or not I get rid of everything is another matter. But it has to complement what the original track was about, the feeling, the whatever that the artist was trying to get over. Yeah. That has to be the point.
Yeah.
With a lot of the stuff I do now, I tend to do a little bit of homework, because the way I work with my partner, Darren Morris, and also with Jo, my wife, we tend to... we find stuff on Spotify, for instance, as ideas, and then we'll flip them between each other, you know, and go, oh, yeah, if we could do the chord progression like that and blah, blah, blah. So that's how we're working now.
Yeah.
And also, Jo Wallace, my wife, she has 4 record labels. So we have F-Star Clear.
Yeah.
That's the house label. So that's now getting into a position of... where people like Francois Kevorkian now are becoming big fans. Then we've got Ramrock Red. Now, Ramrock Red is jazz, hip-hop, rock, left-field stuff, and that's now beginning to take off. Ramrock Blue is soul. That's not as frequent as the other releases, but that deals with a lot of gospel. And then we have Ramrock, which is the original label. That's reggae.
The whole breadth there.
Yeah.
And
Ramrock, the original label, started off as a kind of like satellite for Adrian Sherwood.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff that he couldn't put out on Warp Records, he used to give it down to us.
Yeah.
So, but we're still going to be working with Adrian as well, which is great, because he only lives up the road from us.
Why not?
Fenton, why not? And he's an old friend as well. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Joe was kind enough to send me some of the promos and
things that
are coming out soon. And there was...
the Glenn Davis.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's the one Francois has gone bonkers over.
Yeah.
Africans and Mars is a project that's becoming... Me and Darren are kind of growing into it, is the best description. And we will be putting out an album. We will be putting out a series of singles. But it's a kind of... I think Africans and Mars is me and Darren becoming like Martian superheroes. Do you know what I mean? And we've developed this thing, a whole kind of comic structure, like Marvel, I suppose, about what Africans and Mars are about. So that's being developed. There's an album actually done with Kurt Wagner from Lamb Chop and Cosmo, who does the loft parties. She's my manager's... Mrs. Mm-hmm. And she's involved with the album as well, from Monologue, etc. So I need to go back and have a quick brush up with that. But apart from that, that's kind of near enough ready to go.
Yeah, awesome. So, look forward to hearing that.
Yeah, that's really... It's going to take a lot of people by surprise, because it's very ambient.
Yeah.
It's not a record to go running around clubs to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I talk for myself here, but certainly as I've gotten older and been a fan of the scene, you know, my BPMs, they've slowed down over the years.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally. You know, we just wanted to make an album that people could lie on the floor to, basically.
Like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Talk about kind of re-edits and things as well. I mean, you put out the album a few years ago now, Message in the Music.
Yes.
Which is the collection of kind of remixes and re-edits and things like that. I'm thinking of stuff like, there was the one you did, Panama.
Yes.
Kate Bush Running Up That Hill. Yeah. Like those ones. Were you a fan of those tracks originally? Like,
I have to be.
Do an edit of this, or did they just come to you and see, like, Ashley, can you do it?
I have to be a fan of a track to do an edit. And
The
whole edit thing, you know, it's fun. It's a lot of people, there's a huge amount of arguments now about it. I don't do as many as I do, but there's a huge amount of argument, because people like Francois Kevorkian are saying, look, the re-edit thing originally was about an extension of an idea to be played in the clubs so people could dance longer, you know?
Yeah.
Fair enough. And that's a really good an idea. And that's where I'm coming from. So, you know, and sometimes you make the edit shorter because there's a part in it that you don't want in there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You just want the nice parts. But I tend to make edits now because my heavy disco parties and the heavy disco label, and we make edits really just for that now. They're like dub plates, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm only doing probably a couple of legal edits now per year, you know, because to be honest with you, and shoot me down if you want, but a lot of edits being done now are just a pile of shit. You know, they're awful.
Yeah.
They're badly EQ'd. They're not done properly. And I think people have lost the idea of how to actually do a re-edit in terms of, okay, do them on a computer, which I do, because I used to do them on tape with a blade, you know, but do them on a computer, but you still got to think logically how this works if you had a tape and a blade, how that would fit with that, you know, and what's the bit that makes people go, woo, you know, that's what it's about.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that there is so much out there in terms of edits, and what they're originally, what kind of piqued my interest about them like a few years back was, oh my goodness, all of these tracks that I could never DJ before that I was always a fan of, I can suddenly play a longer version of, it's quantized or whatever. But yeah, like you say, there is, you have to really sort through a lot of, like, someone's just whacked a real hard, harsh 4/4 beat on the back of this.
Yeah, I can't stand it, you know. And all my edits I try and do in Logic without, now what do we call it now? What is the expression now? Where you set it to timing? I don't do that. It's ears. Yeah, it's ears, you know.
Yeah.
So if you play my edits, pretty much you'll see a BPM change going on as the track goes on, you know. And it really spoils it for people who try and mix it.
Well, I think you need that looseness, don't you? That that je ne sais quoi that you know, you don't necessarily get just from an output from a computer.
No, exactly. So yeah, but I've just finished doing Rare Pleasure, who were a 70s disco group, and I've just someone has found a company called HHO, have just found a load of unreleased stuff of theirs, rang me up. And they did an incredible record called Let Me Down Easy.
It's the Needin' You sample.
Needin' You sample, And they rang me up and said, look, we found this all unreleased shit, Ash. And I was like, wow. And they sent it to me, and I was like, okay, let's go. But they had to master off of an acetate, because they didn't actually have the tape.
Right.
But the acetate was a good master.
Yeah.
And then I've gone in and obviously cleaned it up and redone it. And yeah, so that'll be coming out at some point. Amazing. In the next couple of months,
I look forward to hearing that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you're involved in all of the record labels that you're involved in, you mentioned, all cover all kinds of different breadths of genres and everything. You know, it's not necessarily all about dance music, you know, it's funk, soul, reggae, etc.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think the scene as a whole, in terms of all that kind of dance music encompassing everything, do you think is in a healthy place at the moment compared to where it might have been, or what are your thoughts on the future?
I think do you want my honest opinion about this, because I have this conversation all the time. It's in a very healthy place. The only problem being is there's no scene, i.e. there's not a tribe, there's not a collective to carry the movement or carrying the music around. So I'm sitting with you, for instance. You'll tell me about a particular record and we can talk about it, but there's no club that necessarily will be playing it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Everything's kind of shifted online. Records, yes. You know, there's no community within a record shop.
No.
But the community is kind of, you know, it's out there, but it's like smoke.
Yeah. And I think it's a real shame, you know, and everything's online now. Everything's online. And I am sadly as guilty of, you know, because if I need to buy certain records now, where do I go? Online.
Yeah.
You know, it keeps, you know, I'll buy directly from record shops, but because I live in Ramsgate, it's easier for me to just go online and order and they get delivered the next day, you know, whatever.
I mean, and where's that kind of next generation that will learn from the sleeve notes of physical albums they can hold in their hands?
Yeah.
It's a lot harder to research this stuff now, I think.
Yes.
As much as it's easy online to get online and find the information, you actually actively have to go out and seek it rather than having it in your hands.
Yes, exactly.
What have you got coming up that you're excited about?
Black Science Orchestra.
That was my next question. Potential reunion is
it's happened.
Down.
It's happened.
Has it really?
Myself and Rob Mello. Yeah. So it's happened. Yeah, and it's we've already started recording a track which is with Amy Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
So that will happen. I mean, I don't mind announcing that because by the time this comes out, people will be aware.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've got together and we've actively started recording, and we're gonna do what we never did before, which was Black Science Orchestra never DJed, so we're gonna DJ, and we're also gonna take it out live as well, which will be fantastic. You know, we'll have a musical director, strings, the whole lot. So yeah.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah, I just got to rob a bank.
Well, yeah, if you build it, they will come, hopefully.
They will come, yeah, exactly, yeah. Oh, but yeah, so that's going to be, that's the Black Science Orchestra, and there's an Ashley Beadle solo album, which is probably going to be a mini album rather than a full piece. It's going to be probably a 6-track album, just as a kind of reflection of how my head is at the moment, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something that's, I'm talking to one particular label I can't give away yet, but they're very well respected, and he's a very good friend of mine who runs a label, so
okay.
Yeah,
cool. Well, I'd be interested to see how that develops.
Yeah.
And yeah, so we always ask for 5 tracks for submissions for our Spotify playlist.
Yes.
Perfect playlist is that we're building, and there are 5 obviously themes. I'll put them down here for you, so in case you might not remember what they are.
War stories, yes.
So just kind of a little, I suppose, thumbnail sketch of your experience about these tracks. The first one obviously is always the catalyst.
Yeah,
the
well, we spoke
house music. Yeah,
we spoke about this earlier, didn't we? It's Adonis, No Way Back, which came out on the Chicago house label Tracks.
Yeah.
And that really, for me, and I've said this so many times, was the, even though I'd probably heard house music prior to that, that was the particular record that made me go, oh, this is house music.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And is that the first record where someone mentions jacking?
He says Too Far Gone, There's No Way Back.
Yeah.
That
yeah. maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next one is The Floor Filler.
Hard Drive, Deep Inside. Yeah.
Yeah,
I've got my own.
From the very beginning?
There's a Kenny Dope mix that came out, and I did my own edit of it, and it lasts about 11 minutes long. And I've done an intro of about 3 minutes of just deep inside, deep down inside. It's an extraordinary record.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, I'm a huge fan of Masters of Work, always have been. And Louis and Kenny, when they were on top of the game, they still are.
Yeah,
but they do their own thing separately, I suppose, now. But that for me is when you play it, it just brings so much joy to a room.
Yeah,
you know, everyone knows it.
Yeah,
it's a big girl's tune as well. I love it. You know,
and it's you have to have them, don't you?
Yeah, and it samples Barbara, whose name we couldn't remember.
I want to say Barbara Tucker.
Barbara Tucker.
Yes.
That's it. Yes. Yes. Yeah,
perfect.
I think it samples Beautiful People, doesn't
yes.
it? Yeah.
And I think that it's probably been brought to a whole new audience as well now, because Kanye West sampled it, didn't he? Fade, which samples another Acid House record as
That's
well.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that makes you sit up and take notice when you hear that sample. And a Sunsetter is...
Mama, Unmask Me.
Yeah, I mean,
now,
so beautiful, that track.
Very, very, very lucky, because one of my good friends is Hannah Holland. She lives in Margate, not far from here, and she approached me about doing the remix. Or was it me that approached her? Can't remember. Anyway, whatever. Straight away I knew this is a classic. And I did the mix, gave it back to Hannah, and she went, oh my God, this is wonderful, you know. And so I got to thank Hannah for allowing me to do it. And then Andrew Weatherall contacted me, as he always does when he hears one of my records and he likes it. He said, Ash, you know, this is awesome. And he said, I'm doing a Convenenza, is it Convenenza, the festival he does? Yeah. And he said, I'm going to play at the end of my set. And he goes, this is so true. And he went, I'm going to have a little dance to it and we're going to get him to film it. And he did. And it was extraordinary. And the feedback that came off of Facebook and, you know, social media in general, of Andrew there in his, you know, stripy crew neck, just going out and swooning to this bloody record, you know. And I think it's, for me, it's fitting, I think, for how can I say it, the departing of Andrew to another planet. Do you know what I mean? Because he was a very dear friend and a great supporter, believe it or not, of my music, and I was a great supporter of this, even though people were thinking, hey, how does that work? But trust me, if you're into music, you're into music. It doesn't matter what genre, whatever. You know, Andrew was a great believer in the force of music and what it could do for people, you know. So with that, you know, for him to support Mama, and he, you know, was a beautiful thing, and I was really, really proud to be involved in actually remixing that track. And also for you know, Darren Morris, my partner, studio partner, because, you know, he played a large part in bringing that to life as well.
And I think that Andrew Weatherall video you mentioned, I think it's going to be an iconic moment, I think, that will live on.
Absolutely.
And well, just easily segue into the tearjerker.
Don't make me cry.
Sorry, I'm not. We have had people cry, so don't worry if well, you do shed
now,
a tear. But
I'll start at the beginning here. I have one of my ex-partners or ex-wife was Katie Ellis, who works for Anglo Management, and she was a very good friend of. I think she wasn't. I don't know if she was managing Holly Johnson. She was involved in his career anyway at the time. I became quite friendly with Holly. And, you know, I was a big fan of Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
I love Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Amazing, yeah. Amazing. And anyway, over the years, me and Holly would talk quite a lot over the phone, you know. And one day, this appeared, Follow Your Heart, the Frankie Knuckles and Eric Cupper director's cut. And I was smitten by how beautiful and incredible. I'm not quite sure. I think it might have been the last track Frankie Knuckles ever did.
Yeah, that director's cut series was certainly at the end.
And there was a moment I did Festival Number 6. Joe was up there with me. And I'd done I did an outstanding set. And I played this Follow Your Heart as the last record. And a religious experience happened, definitely did. And I won't say, you know, fuck where I come from in terms of the religious attitude, but I had an experience. I don't know what was going on, but I remember I turned around to Joe and I was crying my heart out, you know. And it was just that I think what Frankie did musically and what Holly Johnson said lyrically summed up everything for everybody at that particular point. You know, the kids that were dancing, the old schoolers who were backstage, everything. Everyone just looked at each other and went, what the fuck? You know what I mean? And, you know, I always use this word a lot. It's become my go-to word, but it was an extraordinary, still is an extraordinary record, and I will never stop playing it.
I mean, it's got everything. It's got a real Frankie Knuckles, Eric Cupper sound to it. Really soft, but driving. The vocals and the lyric is so positive and uplifting. And it's got Holly Johnson singing it. Can't get better, can you?
You can't. And he's an absolutely lovely man. You know, so all praises due to Holly, and all praises due to Frankie and Eric Cupper.
Absolutely. And okay, so it's the end of the night. One more tune. We've talked about it already, but I don't know if there's anything more to say about it. But
well, you know what? It's one of those, and it's it's Lazy Express 2, and you know, very, very proud to be involved in a team, if you like, that made that record. Do you know what I mean? And you know, and I'd like to give my extreme thanks to David Byrne and Rocky and Diesel, you know. And David Byrne, we've talked post it, you know, and he's a very funny guy, very, very funny guy. But we did hear now, this will, I don't know when the film's come out, so when this interview comes out,
yeah,
it might be you've been. But we did get a call from my publishing company, BMG, mm-hmm, about 4 or 5 days ago. And they said, can you agree to Lazy being used in a film called American Utopia? And I said, okay, I think so. Let me think about it.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, you know, well, David Byrne's given his permission already. And we're like, oh, okay. So I spoke to my manager, Adam, you know, and told him about it. And he called me back and he went, you do know it's David's film, don't you? And I went, what's it? He said, it's David's last tour,
yeah,
of, you know, which he did. And Lazy's in the film. But then we found out who the director was. Spike Lee.
Oh, my God.
So...
You cannot say no.
Yeah. So that, for me, was the final, you know, the grace of God came down. I was like, well, yeah, Lazy. It's finally reached the point it's meant to have made.
Yeah.
And Diesel said to me a couple of days ago, you know, prior to this interview, he said that, you know, when you make a record like that and that's where it ends up in a film that Spike Lee's directed, you can go to fucking heaven happy.
Absolutely. Wow, yeah, that's fantastic. The final question we always ask is, we've kind of almost covered it in a way, but I don't know if you want to add anything more to it. You've obviously been involved with house music and the culture of dance music across multiple genres your whole career. What has it brought to you in your life, and how do you feel about it, kind of looking back at the oeuvre of work you've got?
Let's say something, and I'm going to say only the one sentence, yeah? It saved me. That's it.
Bang. Perfect place to end.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Awesome. Now, are you hungry?
House Culture.
Gotta love that mic drop at the end there, right? Ashley Beadle, what a lovely guy. When I told people that know him that I was interviewing him, everyone said how nice he was, and I can honestly say it was an absolute pleasure to chat to him from start to finish. I hope you enjoyed it as well. Also, I must say this interview was recorded back in February, a few days after the sad death of one of Ashley's musical mentors, Andrew Weatherall. Obviously, things were still a bit raw, but I want to personally thank Ash for taking the time out to sit with me, as well as tell a few stories about the great man. It's massively appreciated. Now, if you want to listen to that soon-to-be iconic Unmask Me track that got Mr. Weatherall dancing behind the decks, or even hear any of the tunes we discussed in our chat, you can find them all and much, much more on our playlist on Spotify. All you need to do is search for House Culture Perfect Playlist, and there you'll find not only the choices from Ashley Beadle, but from every guest we've had on both seasons of the podcast so far. There's all kinds of stuff in there covering every facet of house music culture, so give it a shuffle, turn it up loud. Once you're listening to that, please help support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, and rating or reviewing us on Apple. Please. It's really important, does make a difference, so get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. If you say something nice enough, we could give you a mention on a future episode. Which is why I'm going to say a massive thanks to Rupert Bradley from the US, whose review on Apple says that as he is learning to DJ himself, knowing the background of the music he loves goes a long way. Well, Rupert, this is what this series is all about, and I wish you the very best of luck as you embark on your dance music journey. And if you want to join us on our own voyage, please hit up our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet or follow the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. Not only will you be fully informed about the podcast, you'll also get connected with other house music lovers the world over. And finally, if you want to get in touch with me, Matt Rouse, you can do it directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. See you next time.
House Culture.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.